Okay, so it's now at 3 o'clock. So, once the monks are down, we can begin. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. So today, being the second Sunday of the month, is the Sutta class. And as many of you know, that today also we celebrated the new Deer Day in Southeast Asia, Songkran. And so I thought, should I not do a Sutta class today? So I decided to do the shortest of the Sutta classes, which is supposed to be the Bahya Sutta. But then one thing led to another with all the explanations. There's more to the Bahya Sutta than just the first few lines. So anyway, here we go with the Bahya Sutta. So, Bahya, you should train yourself thus. In the seen will be merely what is seen. In the heard will be merely what is heard. In the sensed will be merely what is sensed. And that is explained as the smelt and the tasted, and the felt by the body. And in the cognized will be merely what is cognized. Practicing in this way, Bahya, you will not be because of that. When you are not because of that, you will not be in that. And when you are not in that, then you'll be neither here nor beyond nor in between the two. Just this is the end of suffering. And through this brief teaching, Bahya was immediately enlightened. So that is from the Udana. And that is often quoted as, wow, just that much and you are fully enlightened. Now, the back story. Bahya was not a monk. The sutta does not record him giving dana, nor taking refuge in the triple gem, nor keeping any precepts. Moreover, the sutta has no mention at all of Bahya ever meditating, let alone reaching a jhana. Yet after receiving a very brief teaching from the Buddha, Bahya became fully enlightened, an arahat within literally seconds. This episode is very well known in Buddhist circles because it seems to make enlightenment so easy. And it appears you don't even need to renounce to be a monk or a novice or a nun, nor you need to keep any like 8 precepts. You can be miserly and not give any dana. No ceremonies such as that of taking refuge are required. Precepts are unnecessary, and even meditating can be avoided. What a relief for some. All you need is intelligence. And everyone thinks they're intelligent, if you ask people. This makes Bahya's teaching both attractive and notorious. And as usual, there is more to the story than is recorded in this sutta. It is often the case that the suttas record only the highlights of a long episode. Just like the wedding photos do not record the first meeting, the dating and the proposal, so many suttas do not record all that occurred before the finale. So what is the full story of Bahya? How can we put the finale, captured for posterity in the Udana, into its full context? Fortunately, the whole story is recorded in the Upadana, the past lives of arahats, and in the commentaries, and in a couple of other suttas too. But first of all, the back story.
in his previous life, Bahia was recorded as a monk under the Buddha Kassapa, as the previous Buddha. So it's not that we have one Buddha, that when Buddhism disappears, then another one comes. Who is supposed to be the next Buddha? Maitreya, yes. So we have Gautama, Siddhartha Gautama, or Sakyamuni, current Buddha, and before him was the Buddha Kassapa. In his previous life, Bahia was a monk under the Buddha Kassapa. Together with six other monks, he climbed a steep mountain, throwing away the ladder and determined to remain on top of that rock until they became enlightened or died. One of the seven monks became an arahat. Another became an anagami. An anagami is a non-returner. Very close to being enlightened, but just on that third stage of enlightenment, not fully enlightened. And the other five died on the mountain. And Bahia was one of those five. In Bahia's final life, he was a sailor. This the time he got enlightened. Successfully crossing the ocean seven times. On the eighth voyage, he was shipwrecked, but managed to survive by floating ashore on a plank of wood. Having lost all his clothes, he made temporary garments out of bark and went begging for food in the town of Suparakar, which is just north of Mumbai. The townspeople were impressed with his appearance and offered him food, respect, and even a costly set of clothes. When Bahia refused the new clothes, the people esteemed him even more. Bahia had gained a comfortable living and so did not need to return to sea. The people regarded Bahia as an arahat, and soon Bahia thought he was an arahat too. Now that's, I'll pause there, because anybody who's ever been to India, and sometimes you see, it's like sadhus, holy men, and mostly holy men, but not real holy men. These are people who, just because of their appearance, get a lot of respect. And this was such in the case of Bahia. In this particular time, having lost all his possessions almost his life when he was at sea, and just wearing just bark, you know, that's pretty ascetic, and people would give him free food, respect, and he thought that's much better than doing honest work. So he was very happy just being a yogi. Any comments so far? Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Good question is that at that time, people thought he was an arahat. He thought he was an arahat. What did he actually mean by an arahat? Because at that particular time, did Buddhism actually spread to that west coast of India? Was it well known? But people had the idea of an arahat throughout India a long time before the Buddha. Exactly what an arahat was, not really sure, but they knew that it was somebody who would not get reborn, ended their bad karma, would have no attachments, would have no simple living, not collecting possessions. There was a certain amount of knowledge of what an arahat should be. In the same way, even today, there is an understanding of like what a monk is. Even though people never met monks before, you know, they know that a monk should be someone who's simple living, who doesn't sort of get married, who's celibate, and who doesn't amass possessions.
there's certain qualities of that word monk, which even if you don't know much about Buddhism or Christianity, people know that this is, you know, just the, you know, what a monk is. The same with arahat in India. Most people had an understanding of what an arahat was. And so that, even it may not have been an accurate understanding, it was enough for them to think this was a person who was, it literally means worthy. Yes. Now, first of all, let's just continue your question. Yeah.
From your explanation, I just caught the first word you said. He was not, arahant is not reborn again, is it? Not born again or not reborn again?
Not reborn again, yes. That's the last life, no more rebirth. That is the common understanding of an arahat, which would probably be there in that time.
Can I ask, relevant to now, the word not reborn again?
Yeah.
I'm more concerned we are human beings, okay, and we have this physical body. I don't want to go into the five aggregate or the sixth sense basis yet. When we say we are not reborn again, and we are now reading the triple gen of Gautama Buddha, what does not reborn again imply? Does it mean that we are out of this universe of physical?
Yeah.
Because according to your teaching, there's three worlds.
Yes.
Rupa world. Five sense world, Rupa world, Arupa world.
Yeah, very good.
Not reborn again. Looks like there are many schools at this present time, and I want to make sure where do we stand with you as our teacher? What is not reborn for Arahan is?
Yes. Well, he was understanding would probably not very clear to him. Just an arahat, it literally meant worthy. Like somebody who was highly attained. Somebody who was way up there in their spiritual attainments. That is how that they would have understood an arahat in that time. Later on, when the Buddha taught, or when his teachings reached that part of India, that the idea of an arahat would have been more precise. But at that time, it just meant someone who was very worthy. Worthy of respect, worthy of offerings. That type of meaning would probably be how the villagers in the town of Soparika would have had the idea of what an arahat is. But if you ask what an arahat is now, that is something which comes at the end of this sutta, because I add a few extra things later on. So thank you for that.
Any idea if Bahia could remember his past lives at this point?
No, Bahia could not remember his past lives at this point.
So anyway, so because other people thought of him as an arahat, as a saint, as enlightened, that was, he thought he was an enlightened one too. And at that point, a heavenly being, a deva, we'll find out exactly what this deva was in a moment, discerned. In other words, they became aware of this wrong thought of Bahia, and out of compassion, reprimanded him. That deva was none other than his former fellow monk, one of the seven, the one who had become an anagami, the not-returner, on top of that mountain. Just for interest, to add, the remaining four fellow monks were also reborn at this time, and they all, like Bahiya, eventually attained full enlightenment. They were the monks Pukkusati, Sabiya, Kumara Kassapa, who is mentioned in the Digha Nikaya, and Dabba the Malian, Dabba Malaputta, who was another well-known monk, especially occurring in the Vinaya. Dabba Malaputta, Dabba the Malian, he was the novice monk who became, according to the story, enlightened when he was only 7 years of age as a novice, and wondering what to do for the rest of his life, because he was never cut out to be a great teacher, but one of his powers, psychic powers, was to be able to, with what they call the fire element, to actually create a glow on his finger, and with his glowing finger, he could take the monks to dwelling places in the middle of the night. He lived in the area around Rajagaha, and some of you have been to the bamboo grove, the hot springs, Vulture's Peak, and at that particular location where the Buddha spent a long time, either in the bamboo grove, the Veluvana, or the Vulture's Peak, monks would arrive at night time, and he would volunteer. His volunteer job was to be the monk who took the visiting monk to their dwellings. And if they arrived late at night, he didn't need a torch, he would light up his finger, and he would take them up in the mountains, in the paths, to where their accommodation, where they were going to be housed or kutied for the next while. And just like anybody, the word got around that Dabba Mala, Dabba Malaputta, Dabba the Malian, had this psychic power, and even the monks would always like to see this. So they deliberately, on purpose, arrived late at night when it was dark. So he had to get his finger out and light the finger and light the way with his finger. So that was one of the great stories of Dabba Malaputta, Dabba the Malian. And he was one of those monks who was meditating on top of the mountain, and he died up there. But anyway, that this was the Anagami, who was also one of those seven. One became an arahat, one was the Anagami, and Bahiya was one of them, and there's four others made up the seven. So it was the Anagami informed Bahiya about a true arahat, the Buddha, living at that time on the other side of India, in Sarvati. And again, many of you who have been on pilgrimage to India know Sarvati is in the north of the central plains of India, north of India, well, the Ganges Valley, you know, up a bit, close, not that far away, you know, from the borders of Nepal, I suppose, and that Saparika was a well-known port, which was, again, to the west, the long distance. And anyway, where was it going? So about a true arahat, the Buddha, living at that time on the other side of India, at Sarvati. Bahiya immediately left Soparika, present-day Sopara, just north of Mumbai, and reached Sarvati, which is just 17 kilometers west of Balarampur, in only one night. Bahiya met the Buddha while he was on alms round and asked for a teaching. The Buddha at first refused, for it was an inappropriate time, but on being asked a third time, the Buddha interrupted his alms gathering and gave the famous teaching presented above. Within seconds of hearing that Dhamma, Bahia was fully enlightened. A few minutes later, the Arahat Bahia was killed by a cow with calf. So that was some of the story in the Apadana. So Bahia's background was exceptional. He had been a monk under the previous Buddha, Kassapa. His powers of determination were so strong that he went to meditate on the mountain with the resolve to become enlightened or die. And in this life, he had the power to hear a deva speak to him, and he could travel more than halfway across India, some 1,300 kilometers, as the levitator flies, in only one night. And if you had such a background from your previous life and had such psychic powers already in this life, then perhaps you too would have been enlightened when you heard Bahia's teachings a few minutes ago. It is usually the case that one requires very deep samadhi, the jhanas, to achieve such psychic powers. Certainly, Bahia would have had a predisposition for meditation, taking into account of his previous life, and the psychic power of the divine ear that enabled him to hear the deva, and the other psychic power that enabled him to travel so fast, suggests that he was practicing jhana before he heard the deva. Perhaps this was another reason why he thought himself an arahat. But there is more evidence to suggest that though it was not mentioned in that text, Bahia had been practicing jhanas. Pause before I go on to a sutta, which is in the in the Samyutta. Okay, it fills in some of the extra when people just usually mention the Bahia Sutta about in the scene, just the scene. It fills in some more evidence. And now we come to a connecting sutta. But did you have a question there, Cheng? That's only because the people overseas could hear.
I just want to be more relevant.
Yeah.
Based on this last paragraph that you read, you say that we are feeling that he got jhana, and we think that that's why one of the reasons he could think he's arahant. Could that mean he has jhana, but he has wrong view because he assumes he's arahant?
Correct.
And to say that he got wrong view, I'm going to jump many steps. He don't have this he got the wrong. I'm sure Gautama Buddha is at that time already teaching the tree, the non-self,
the dukkha, the anicca.
Anicca and the dukkha.
Yes.
So he might have practiced the jhana. He hasn't used the jhana, the data to apply the right view, am I right?
At correct.
This point, if we are going to just fill in the gap.
Correct. That's very true. Do you know another person who had jhanas, who had psychic powers, and was not fully enlightened? Sorry? Devadatta, yes. Devadatta, the Buddha's cousin.
But just to bring this in, it makes no sense to me as far as I'm concerned, as far as I think. You're just showing that people are so power crazed, and the mind is so twisted, but the Buddha teaching, if I get it right, his first teaching is dukkha, and the dukkha is very specific dukkha, is about this cycle of death and reborn. So why are these, whether they are monk or non-monk, but they are disciple of Buddha, why are they so quickly get carried away, and jhana is not something that it happens to everyone as far as I'm concerned, but it doesn't just happen like that.
Yes. No, that is a case which I saw when I first went to Ajahn Chah's monastery as a monk, which was a case in point. There was a monk, and he developed the ability to hear
discussions at long distances. And he told a few friends, and because making a claim of such psychic ability, if he was boasting, that would be a paratika offence. He would have to leave the monkhood. So it was incumbent on the other monks to check to make sure that he wasn't exaggerating. So they did test him out, and they found his powers were true. He could hear conversations which were happening a long way away, and they checked out to be true. So the next thing which happened, that I found him sitting in Ajahn Chah's chair, where Ajahn Chah would usually receive guests, as if he was the equal or even more powerful than Ajahn Chah. And the next thing which happened was Ajahn Chah took him upstairs to the room above his hut and explained a few things to him. And the next day, this monk came to the hall where we were eating. So we hadn't started eating yet. And he bowed to every monk, senior and junior, including me. I didn't know what was going on, to ask forgiveness for actually making, for allowing his true attainment of being able to have this psychic power to give him such ego and pride that he thought he was equal or even better than Ajahn Chah. And that was the last I saw of him. He disappeared, took his bowl and robe, and went to another probably forest monastery somewhere to continue his practice, realizing the danger of having such jhanas, psychic powers, without a good grounding of Dhamma. So it was that jhanas literally fed his ego in the same way that they fed the ego of Devadatta. We've continued the conversation with Cheng first.
Just finish one last question.
Yes, yeah.
The previous paragraph, how do we understand the phrase which is so important? He killed, a moment later or a few minutes later, he's killed by a cow with a calf. This is, to me, it's very important. I think you call it metaphor. Is this important? How am I to understand this phrase? Because there is a lot of other sutta that when this phrase comes up, there is a lot of deep significant meaning. I don't know what, but I can sense it.
I don't know of any deep significance in it, but I do know that my own experience in northeast Thailand was that not so much cows, but the water buffalo would often charge, run at monks for no reason. They'd be very docile, very calm animals. But when we were going on arms round, sometimes they would lift up their head. And that was a danger signal. We were taught that that meant they were very scared. And then, if you didn't sort of get out of the way quickly, they would charge you. And some monks would get gored, by the horns of those water buffaloes, kwai. And even that happened to me a couple of times. You had to be very fast. And I remember in great detail when I was carrying the bowl of Ajahn Sumedho, and he was the two of us, and a water buffalo charged us and ran really fast. And so, it's no sort of walking mindfully, it's running as fast as you can. And Ajahn Sumedho went one way, I went another way. And certainly at that time, Ajahn Sumedho had much more good karma than I did. So the water buffalo started chasing me. I should have gone with Ajahn Sumedho at the time. But, I went behind a tree, and just then the water buffalo calmed down. To this day, I don't know why water buffalo do that, but only surmise that their sight is not that good. In the same way that the sight of kangaroos is not that good. You know, you see that in the forest monasteries. Hearing is pretty good. So, because of that, you can see that probably if their sight is not good, they see something of this colour, they probably think that this is a tiger. Same type of colour. So that's my sort of theory, that the water buffalo thinks it's a tiger and just want to chase it away. I don't know. But anyway, that's just a theory. But I can see why monks could be attacked and killed. It says here cow with calf, but I think it's much more like it is like a water buffalo. Okay, you've had your hands up for a while, but is that a separate question, a separate stuff or similar? We'll give it to Bill first of all, and then to Nicholas.
Yes, again, did the other three monks, or the group of four, did they attain enlightenment as easy as Bahia or not?
I don't think so. They're not sure about how they attained enlightenment, but they all became pretty well-known monks, repeated every now and again in the suttas.
Ajahn, if Bahia was a once-returner, he would have had, like, perfect view. So his idea that he was enlightened, is that to be understood that it was a genuine mistaken view, but it was impersonal?
We don't know exactly what he thought, but it seems to be that, you know, he was a person who had a natural simplicity to him. He was offered clothes, but he didn't want them. And it's also that he was, he had some sort of powers there. He wasn't a normal person. And so all you needed was people worshipping him. And then after a while, people think, wow, look at all these people coming listening to my talks. Look at all these people who actually listen to me on YouTube. Look at all these people who buy my books. Whoa, I must be somebody. So sometimes, you know what I'm talking about, sometimes it's the dangers of gains, honour and fame, which the Buddha always talked about. So just because people listen to you and they say sadhu, sadhu, sadhu after a good talk, and that's just because they may think all sorts of things about you, that doesn't mean that you're an arahat. So that's why you've got to be very careful. So he was given that gains, honour and fame. And that's why, after a while, he started believing it. What people tell you. Oh, all these people, you know, they tell me, just I'm really sort of so intelligent and wise and the best husband in the world, and so maybe I must be. So that's where that one comes from. Okay, yeah, Nicholas?
I find that I can't quite understand that because, I mean, if he was a once-returner, wouldn't he have perfect view?
He would have good view as a once-returner, but we don't know if he was a once-returner yet. So we'll see what happens in a few moments. So, we have here a few people aware that the very same teaching that here I call Bahi is teaching in the scene, there'll only be the scene, occurs in another part of the suttas. And it's in the Samyutta Nikaya. And it is another Bahiya Sutta that's in there, but also there is in there the story of Bahiya's teaching given to the old monk Malunkya Putta. And he's one of my favorite monks because I'll quote later on that in the 64th sutta of the Majjhima Nikaya, the Buddha makes one of his clearest statements that you cannot become enlightened, full enlightened or a non-returner, without the experiences of a jhana. But anyway, this is another teaching to the same monk, Malunkya Putta. Venerable Malunkya Putta approached the Buddha and said to him, "Venerable sir, it would be good if the Buddha would teach me the Dhamma in brief." so that having heard the Dhamma from the Buddha, I might dwell alone, secluded, diligent, ardent, and resolute. Malunkyaputta, replied the Buddha, what should I say to the young monastics when an old monk like you, come to the last stage of life, ask me for an exhortation in brief? The way I understand that is, they would also just want an exhortation in brief and not want to be trained at all. So although, venerable sir, I am old, let the Buddha teach me the Dhamma in brief. Perhaps I might understand the meaning of the Buddha's statement. Now, Malunkyaputta here is an old monk. What do you think, Malunkyaputta? Do you have any desire, lust or affection for objects of sight that you have not seen and never saw before, that you do not see and would not think might be seen? No, venerable sir. This is have not seen, never saw before. In other words, you want to see them, or just fantasies. No, venerable sir. Do you have any desire, lust, or affection for those sounds cognizable by the ear, those odors cognizable by the nose, those tastes cognizable by the tongue, those tactile objects cognizable by the body, for those mental phenomena cognizable by the mind, that you have not cognized, never cognized before, that you do not cognize or would not think might be cognized? No, venerable sir. So here, Malunkyaputta, regarding things seen, heard, sensed, and cognized by you, in the seen, there will be merely the seen. In the heard, there will be merely the heard. In the sensed, there will be merely the sensed. And in the cognized, will be merely the cognized. As the same teaching was given to Bahya. When Malunkyaputta, and this is expanding that teaching, regarding things seen, heard, sensed, and cognized by you. In the seen be merely the seen, the heard will be merely the heard, the sensed will be merely the sensed, cognized will be merely the cognized. Then, Malunkyaputta, you will not be by that. When Malunkyaputta, you are not by that, you will not be therein. When Malunkyaputta, you are not therein, then you'll be neither here nor beyond nor in between the two. This is the end of suffering. So that was the full teaching which was given to Bahya. Now fortunately Malunkyaputta was not killed by a cow. So he repeated the teaching to the Buddha just to make sure he understood it correctly. So Malunkyaputta replied to the Buddha, I understand in detail, venerable sir, the meaning of what was stated by the Buddha in brief. Having seen a form with mindfulness distorted, attending to the pleasing sign, one experiences it with an infatuated mind and remains tightly holding to it, then many feelings flourish within, originating from the visible form, covetousness and annoyance as well, by which one's mind becomes disturbed. For one who accumulates suffering thus, Nibbana is said to be far away. Having heard a sound, smelt an odor, enjoyed a taste, felt a contact, known an object with mindfulness distorted, for one who accumulates suffering thus, Nibbana is said to be far away. On the contrary, when mindfulness is without hindrances, one is not excited by lust for whatever is seen, one experiences it with dispassion and does not remain holding to it tightly, one fares mindfully in such a way that even as one sees and experiences a feeling, suffering is exhausted, not built up. For one dismantling suffering thus, Nibbana is said to be close by. When mindfulness is without hindrances, one hears a sound, smells an odor, enjoys a taste, feels a contact, knows an object. In all those cases, one is not excited by lust for these objects. And similarly, one diminishes suffering thus. Nibbana is said to be close by. And the Buddha replies, Sadhu Malunkyaputta, it is good that you understand the meaning of what was stated thus by me, in brief. So that gives an expansion of the teachings about what it means to actually, in the seen will be just the seen, the heard will just the heard. It was being able to know these things without mindfulness distorted, and instead to know them when the hindrances are not present. So one actually sees what is really there, rather than what you add onto it. The venerable Malankyaputta, delighted and rejoiced in the Buddha's words, rose from his seat and, after paying homage, keeping him on his right, departed. Later, dwelling alone, secluded, diligent, ardent and resolute, the venerable Malankyaputta, by realizing it for himself with direct knowledge in this very life, entered and dwelt in that unsurpassed goal of the holy life he directly knew, destroyed his birth, the holy life has been lived. What had to be done has been done, and there is no more rebirth. And Venerable Malankyaputta became one of the Arahats. A little bit slower, not so immediate, but in this version from the suttas explains what it means in the herd. In the seen is just the seen. In the herd is just the herd. It's with mindfulness not distorted by the five hindrances. And I think many of you know that what we see, we very rarely see what is there. We see what we want to see. Or we see, or we don't see, what is repelling to us. We hear, we often wonder, have conversations with people. That's not what I said. Ah, but it's what you heard. Or even smelt and tasted. Sometimes, apparently, I have to do this one day, they have these restaurants which are dark, where you can't see what you're eating. They put it in front of you. And I don't know what food you don't like. They may put food in there you really don't like, and you put it in your mouth. Oh, this is really nice. I wonder what that was. And you find it was like a fried cockroach, which you would never eat if you saw it. But who knows, it may be tasty. But anyway, so what happened? If you saw, I haven't eaten cockroaches, not unless I don't think so, but certainly you have eaten the fried crickets used to have, you know, in Thailand. They're actually really quite tasty. And you know, little crickets, you can see it's a cricket, and actually they're really just quite okay. But if you gave them to you today, you go, ugh, I'm not eating that. Because it's what we add on to the taste. In other words, we distort our perceptions. So anyway, that's one of the problems. That's what the Buddha means about, you know, in the scene, just the scene. We don't distort the scene because it's what we think is like beautiful and we want it. Or we don't distort the scene because that's our enemy. Ugh. We already know what they're going to do. We distort it, they become our enemy because what we see in them. But we go further. Malankyaputta, same person, also appears in Sutta 64, the Majjhima Nikaya, where the Buddha begins by scolding Malankyaputta for his wrong view, then teaches the necessity of attaining at least one of the jhanas in order to know what the lower fetters really are, and then relinquish them. I always point out that it's not just relinquishing, letting go of those attachments, it's even know what the heck they are, what you're supposed to let go of. And the Buddha made it very clear to even know them, let alone let them go. You do need a jhana experience. And, how where have I gone now? Oh yeah. The Buddha said in front of Venerable Malankyaputta, it is impossible to achieve non-returning, let alone full enlightenment, without a jhana. just as much as it is impossible to reach the heartwood of a tree without first going through its bark and sapwood. So Venerable Malokyaputta was first taught the necessity of jhanas, and later he was given Bahiya's teaching. And after hearing Bahiya's teaching, dwelling alone, withdrawn, diligent, ardent and resolute, Malokyaputta soon became an arahat. It is therefore certain that Malokyaputta achieved the jhana before Bahiya's teaching could be effective, or else the Buddha would be blatantly inconsistent. It also adds weight to the inference that Bahiya also had experience of jhana before he heard the same teaching. Otherwise, he would have reached the heartwood of the tree without going through its bark and sapwood. So what did Bahiya and Venerable Malokyaputta see in the Buddha's words that generated the arahat experience? What does it mean in the scene would be merely the scene? What it means is to see without distortion of the data, without adding or subtracting from it. As even modern psychology knows, what comes to our attention as the scene has already been sifted and distorted by our desires and aversions. This process of distortion occurs prior to the event of cognition. It is impossible to see this process as it occurs. It is subconscious, or maybe I call it preconscious. We can only infer its occurrence. We discover that our preferences have embellished the data to present to our mind what we wanted to see, while hostility has denied any access to the mind for those features that we didn't want to see. What we see is really merely the scene. That which we see with bare attention is seldom the truth. It is not the way things are. It is only the way things seem. The Buddha explained that it is the five hindrances that distort perception and corrupt our thinking. He called the five hindrances the nutriment that feeds delusion. That's from the Anguttara. The first hindrance, sensual desire, selects what we want to see, hear, sense, and cognize. It often embellishes the truth. It presents to our consciousness the product of wishful thinking. The second hindrance is ill will, is that negative impulse that blocks us seeing, hearing, sensing, or cognizing what we don't want to know. It blinds us to what is unpleasant and to what is contrary to our view. Psychology knows the second hindrance as a process of denial. The third hindrance is sloth and torpor. This does not distort what we see, hear, sense, or cognize, but it buries it in a fog so that we are unable to discern clearly. The fourth hindrance, restlessness and remorse, which keeps our senses on the run so fast that we do not have sufficient time to see, hear, sense, or cognize fully. Sights do not have time to fully form on our retina before the back of the eye has another sight to deal with. Sounds are hardly registered when we are asked to listen to something else. The fourth hindrance of restlessness and its special case of remorse, the inner restlessness due to bad conduct, is like the hindrance of restlessness and its special case, it's like the over-demanding boss in your office who never gives you enough time to finish a project properly. And the fifth hindrance is doubt, which interrupts the gathering of data with premature questions. Before we have fully experienced the seen, heard, sensed, or cognized, doubt interferes with the process. Like a cocky student interrupting the teacher with a question in the midst of a lecture without being invited. You should now be able to appreciate that it's these five hindrances that distort perception, corrupt the thinking, and maintain a deluded view. It is well known amongst serious students of Buddhism that the only way to suppress these five hindrances is through the practice of jhana. As it says in the Nalakarpana Sutta, in one who does not attain a jhana, the five hindrances, plus, interestingly, discontent and weariness, invade the mind and remain. Anything less than the jhana is not powerful and lasting enough to suppress the five hindrances sufficiently. So even if you are practicing bare mindfulness with the five hindrances still active at a subconscious level, you are not seeing things as they truly are. You see things as they seem, distorted by the five hindrances. Thus, in order to fulfill the Buddha's teachings to Bahiya and Venerable Malankyaputta, in order that in the seen will be merely what is seen, in the heard will be merely what is heard, in the sensed will be merely what is sensed, and in the cognized will be merely what is cognized, the five hindrances have to be suppressed, and that means the jhana. Now, before I go into the final part of Bahiya's teachings, which is about the enlightenment experience of you will not be here because of in between or anywhere else, before we do that, any questions about how that in the seen there'll be merely the seen means that you have to suppress the five hindrances. And the way to suppress the five hindrances long enough is through the jhana. This is how we link up the teaching to Malankyaputta when he first ordained and the teaching as an old monk when he heard the Bahiya's teaching and soon became enlightened. Any comments or questions on that? Yes.
Can I just ask, this, we now go to Malankyaputta,
Yeah, Malankyaputta, yes.
Malankyaputta. We based on his Majjhima Sutta and this Sutta. Can I ask you, can you Ajahn elaborate how then he's an old monk, he got these two, he can have many other teachings, doesn't matter, he got these two teachings, he got jhana, he become arahant. Does he go to, he has to have a, what you call that, wisdom eye.
Yeah.
He has to have that. Then he go to arahant. In between, doesn't matter how many. How can you elaborate for us? Can you elaborate how he go? Well, besides, I know you're trying to tell us that. I definitely accept the five hindrance has to be gone after the jhana, when it's fully suppressed. After coming out of the jhana, the mind is pure. You get the data of jhana or the data of the teaching. How do we go about? How do you think Malankyaputta go about becoming an arahant?
Well, it does seem that for Malankyaputta, that the sutta which occurs in the Samyutta Nikaya, where the Buddha talks him as a very old monk, and in the first sutta where it doesn't mention that at all, does seem to mean that the first sutta where it taught about the necessity of jhanas occurred earlier. And the teaching in the Samyutta where mentioning the Bahiya's teaching came later. So in Malankyaputta's life as a monk, the chronology, the sequence was hearing the necessity of jhanas first and then hearing Bahiya's teaching. Because in Bahiya's teaching he says you're an old monk. In Malankyaputta Sutta doesn't say that. So because of that, we can probably assume that Buddha taught jhanas first of all, and then by his teaching afterwards. Once he had the jhanas, or the Buddha thought he had the jhanas, then it was appropriate to teach Malankyaputta in the scene will be just the scene.
I follow what you're saying. So this Samyutta Sutta.
Yeah.
Okay, we got it clear. Malankyan have to have the jhana experience, and he has a jhana experience. The Samyutta, you know, the earlier few paragraphs ahead, where the mindfulness attraction, Buddha asked him a question: Are you still attract or are you still holding on to? have you have desire for this object in the future?
Yeah.
That whole teaching, the whole questioning, I read it as he also let go. Marunka can test himself that he really also the future has dropped out. He already let go of the future of all this clinging, which means that he actually let go of. He quite certain he has let go of this five sense world.
Yes, but had he really? He was not enlightened yet. But later on, after hearing that Bahia's teaching, in a scene will be just a scene, he understood it. And then he went off and practiced and then became enlightened, living in seclusion. But what I wanted to make sure there is that just to hear Bahia's teaching is not enough. We already established, as you were saying and asked very well earlier, just having jhanas is not enough. People like Devadatta become proud with that. And just having just the knowledge, the great teachings to Bahia, is not enough. You need both. As they say, you need the jhanas and the teaching. But we come to the final parts of Bahia's teaching, which people love to think about, because you will not be because of that. Because you're not because of that, you'll not be in that. When you're not in that, you wouldn't be neither here nor beyond nor in between the two. Justice is the end of suffering. Now that looks like very Zen, which means that without a good explanation, people will often think, my goodness me, that is so deep, and it allows people to have all their theories about what it means. But the final part of Bahia's teaching. Bahia, you should train yourself thus. In the scene will be merely the scene, and the cognized will be merely the cognized. Practicing this way, Bahia, you will not be because of that. When you're not because of that, you'll not be in that. When you're not in that, you will be neither here nor beyond nor in between the two. Justice is the end of suffering. What does that mean? To start off, what does it mean you will not be because of that? The Pali is natena, tena is the instrumental. Please excuse me for going into grammar, but this is the only way you can really get into what this means. Is the instrumental of the word for that, and that is the negative. It means literally not because of that, not through that, not by that. It means in essence you will not assume that there is a self, a soul, a me, a mind because of, through or by the seen or the heard or the sensed or the cognized. The Buddha is saying that once you have penetrated the truth of sensory experience by suppressing the hindrances through jhanas, you will see there is no doer nor a knower behind sensory experience. You are not through that, you're not in that, you're not by that, so you don't exist behind sensory experience. No longer you'll be able to use sensory experience as evidence for a self. Descartes' famous I am because I think is refuted. You will not be because of thinking, nor because of seeing, because of hearing or senses. In the Buddha's words, you will not be because of that, any sensory experience. When the sensory processes are discarded as tenable evidence for a self, a soul or a me, then you are no longer located in the sensory experience. In the Buddha's words, you will not be in that. You no longer view, perceive or even think that there is a me involved in life. Okay, I don't know why I put this in, this was some time ago. In the words of the Doctor in the original series of Star Trek, it is life, Tim, but not as we know it. There is no longer any sense of self or soul at the center of experience. You are no more in that. And just to close off the loophole that you might think you can escape non-existence of a self or a soul by identifying with a transcendental state of being beyond what is seen, heard, sensed or cognized, the Buddha thunders, and you will not be neither here with the seen, heard, sensed or cognized, nor beyond, outside of the seen, heard, sensed or cognized, nor in between the two, neither of the world nor beyond the world. The last phrase comprehensively confounded the sophists. That's just like philosophers looking for loopholes. In summary, the Buddha advised both Bahia and Venerable Malankyaputta to experience the jhanas, to suppress the five hindrances, Thereby one would discern with certainty the absence of a self or a soul behind the sensory process. Consequently, sensory experiences will never again be taken as evidence of a knower or a doer, such that you will never imagine a self or a soul at the center of experience, not in that, nor beyond, nor anywhere else. Bahia's teaching, put in a nutshell, the way to the realization of no self, anatta. Just this, concluded the Buddha, is the end of suffering. So enlightenment requires all of the Eightfold Path. Requires the faith in the Triple Gem, keeping the precepts, the practice of Dharana. There is only one path to Nirvana, and that is the Noble Eightfold Path. No shortcuts. Any questions? Comments? Complaints? So Bahia's teaching used to be pretty short, but because it's short, it can sometimes be misinterpreted. So we add this from the suttas, put another thing else to put all the parts of the jigsaw puzzle together. Any questions from the floor? Okay, we've got some questions from overseas. Here we go. Two questions. Why in the sutta there are no female arahat or bodhisattva? It seems there are no enlightened women even today. In the suttas there are many tales of enlightened women. It's called the Terigata. The Terigata, the verses of the arahat women, and some of them are some of my favourites. I always praise Patachara, the bhikkhuni. She was the woman who lost her husband, her two children, and her two parents on the same day. And she went crazy. And she was the one who, just lost her mind. And she walked into a teaching given by the Buddha with no clothes on, totally naked. And the lay people listening and the monks, get out of here, you're a naked woman, you shouldn't come into a monastery without any clothes on. But the Buddha said, no, let her in. One of the monks, put a robe around her, just, to protect, her modesty or whatever. And the Buddha taught her a teaching, and she later on became fully enlightened. Her teaching is in the Terigata, Patachara. But the reason I single her out, I think it was her that she was meditating in her hut, and it was the oil lamp, the flame, was put out by a gust of wind. And that was just the one thing which actually, the last little piece, which got her enlightened. Just like the simile by the Buddha, a flame, an oil lamp, depends on three things, the wick, the heat, and the oil. Any one of those things goes out and the flame disappears. It doesn't go anywhere. It just stops. It ceases. It nibbanas. Literally, the word for a flame going out, it nibbanas. And that was a sort of powerful sort of realization which put the teachings of things being conditioned, no reality. When the conditions are stopped, the result stops. It doesn't go anywhere. So the idea of a body and a mind ceasing without remainder, that was clearly established. And the nice thing about Patachara was when I first read the Terigata, well worth a read to show us how many Buddhist enlightened women there were in the time of the Buddha. When I read about her, had all of these stories about nuns meditating for years until they met this great teacher. And they hadn't got very far with their meditation, and the great teacher came along, bam, bam, they were enlightened. And so many of them were just saying that the thing they needed was someone who really knew what they were talking about, and that was the bhikkhuni arahat Patachara. I thought, wow, who is this Patachara? And of course the Buddha said that she was the foremost, the best of bhikkhuni teachers. So that was really, So of course we're female arahats. Bodhisattva in the Theravada, earliest part of the Buddha's teachings, the Bodhisattva was only a person after they were born to the time they became a Buddha. That's just in one life. So they only ever use the word Bodhisattva in the Theravada as the Buddha descending from the Tushita realm until the time under the Bodhi tree in Bodh Gaya. In previous life it was not called a Bodhisattva. They only use that word from the period of birth, actually just entering his mum's womb, until the time under the Bodhi tree. 35 years and a bit was in the womb as well. And that was the time for a called a Bodhisattva. No enlightened women even today? How do you know? Are you sure? There was one of the things I sort of Ajahn Brahm, you missed an opportunity. There was a woman called Meti Gi, and she called herself Kho Suen Luang. And I know that the people I used to hang out with, I suppose, whenever I was in Bangkok, Ajahn Chah used to stay there, Lung Phu Plien used to stay there, and it's actually where I go in when I'm in Bangkok. They have a little hut they built in the back. And the matriarch of that family was a close disciple of this Meti Gi. And there was once she invited me to go and see her. And I thought, no, I'm a bit tired, I want to just go and meditate. And about 6 months later she passed away and died. And then I read her books. And, you know, when you read some of her books, there was a very, very highly attained nun. Meti Gi Kho Suen Luang. You got quite a few of her books. Sort of, one or two books translated into English. Are there any? Who knows, why not? Anyway, how are we able to recognize when we are in a delusion created by the five hindrances? So we may overcome it. What is meant by delusion? You're deluded because you don't know you're deluded. That's why you can't recognize it. Until, similar to that experience, I've told this many times, when I thought I was enlightened, and then just it was the two pots of curry in my fourth year as a monk, sort of in brief, usually had just sticky rice and rotten fish curry. Now the pladek. There's only time, isn't there? The pladek curry. And the pladek was disgusting, but so we had every day. And there really was rotten fish. That was all we had. Rice, sticky rice and pladek. This one day, up all night, meditating, really wonderful experiences. Thought I was enlightened, couldn't see any hindrance at all. I was just, no problems at all. No sleepiness, meditating, no sloth and torpor or drowsiness at all. Full energy, going on arms round, spreading loving kindness to all the whole world. And some of these people who, you know, they had the great good fortune to offer food to a bowl of sticky rice to a newly minted arahat. I thought, wow, they were so lucky. I zapped them, you know, with my loving kindness. But you know what happened? That morning there was two pots of curry, not one. I thought, this is weird, this doesn't happen. And one of them was, no, it was actually pork curry, and did have vegetarian food there then. And it was from town, it was delicious. Well, not really delicious, but it was like edible. The other one wasn't. I thought, wow, the heavenly beings have realized my enlightenment and were also celebrating by giving me a nice feast that morning. And I thought, wow, this is great. And then the head monk, I was number two in line, only four lanes. And then head monk, you know, he saw this curry from town. And he took a scoop and poured this huge scoop of this curry into his bowl. And then another one, and three big scoops he put in there. I mean, no one could eat that much. But it was a big pot, so there's some left. So I didn't mind, there's some left to me, it's okay. But then what he did was unforgivable. He took the good curry, the edible one, and poured it into this big pot of rotten fish curry, took the ladle and stirred it all up in front of me, saying, "It's all the same, it's all the same," having taken his out first. And I thought, that's unacceptable. If you really thought that was all the same, you should have mixed it up before you took yours, you big hypocrite. Now you spoilt my celebration of being an arahat. Uh-oh. Because arahats say likewise, don't get angry. They don't really care too much what they eat. So, and I remember afterwards taking that and slopping just a spoonful of this curry into my bowl. I didn't care anymore. You know, it really is depressing when you think you're enlightened and then you find out you're not. It's the worst, one of the worst experiences. But then, you know, it's great because I could laugh about it afterwards. I didn't laugh about it at the time. Oh, dear. Well, that's actually how you recognize when there's delusion. Because it does generate sort of, especially anger, ill will, fear. Those are the easy ones to recognize. So that's where you recognize them. Sometimes it takes a while, but eventually you see it. So thanks for those two questions. Any other questions you have? The Venerable? Which one's that?
Just to close off the loophole that you might think you can escape the non-existence of a cell, of a soul, by identifying with the transcendental states of
soul. Okay, yeah.
And then the end sentence, the last phrase comprehensively confound the sophist.
The sophist, okay. Sophists are just ones who, like lawyers, trying to sort of find a way around, the logical way around. You're not in the world. There's not a self. Not a self. So it's some of the teachings which sometimes you hear, like ineffable. So ineffable, it's something you can never define by words. It's something which is beyond knowledge. It is something which is just too far beyond. It's not here of the world, not beyond the world. So where the hell is it? Have I got you there? No?
I mean, I'm okay with the words that you explain because I'm not,
yeah.
I'm not, I know my limitation of vocabulary. And
oh, yes, yeah.
But I'm actually very interested. Remember beginning of the sutta, you said, you were trying to explain no more rebirth for arahant.
Oh.
I'm very more interested to learn your teaching, the three worlds, the physical universe, and this world. How do I break this world and beyond the world?
I'm
feeling they are not the three worlds.
Okay, yes. It's not in any world. So not the three worlds, as you say, the world of the sense worlds, and the five sense worlds, karma loka, and the rupa loka, which is based on the four jhanas, and arupa, immaterial attainment jhanas. Three worlds, but is there a place beyond that world? Is there, so not in this world, but it says not beyond this world, but something which is neither in this world nor not in this world. But actually, there is such a realm, in the sense of the old Schrodinger's cat. I always like saying it because I know what that means, being a quantum physicist before. Where they put the cat, Schrodinger's cat. And it was only a thought experiment, just the RSPCA will never allow this to happen in real life anywhere in the world. They put a cat in a box with a cyanide capsule. And the cyanide capsule would only go be broken and kill the cat by a quantum process which had a 50% chance of happening. So after the particular time, they were wondering, is the cat alive or is the cat dead? They hadn't opened the box yet. And the truth of the matter is, And this truth has never been refuted, and it seems to be more and more accepted, was the cat is neither alive nor dead. It's in the third state, a quantum probability state. Not alive, not dead, not in between, but something totally different. Does that confound you?
Yes.
Of course it does.
Sense.
But that is actually truth, as far as we know it. So that's one of the reasons why the sophists say, yeah, is it in some sort of, are you in some sort of quantum state when you're sort of enlightened? You're neither here, you're not here, but you're waiting for some box to be opened to see which one it is.
Can I leave this physics question to the floor, whoever wants it?
Yeah, okay.
Can I just ask you, I am definitely grateful to others' teachers, but
yeah.
I think what I'm going to say, I don't mean to be offensive, I just want to learn more.
Yeah, good, yeah.
I think Bhikkhu Bodhi got a state that is called transcendence. I don't know whether it's a transcendental world, transcendental state, or whatever he's... It must be, he still believes in that transcendental state of being beyond. I'm not being rude or offensive, because there must be a lot of his disciples and his books, and I'm very grateful for his book, but I've got a feeling that a lot of, even Theravada got these transcendental states.
Yeah.
Or, I mean, this word transcendent.
Yeah, it's,
like there is still an entity around, even though they say there's not, they believe, they understand the tree, the non-self teaching of Buddha.
Indeed, yes.
So it's just,
so
it's difficult to read because people like us who are not good in language ability, we just want simple. And so what the question I asked beginning, and you said, then what, does Arahant still alive?
Yeah, the Arahant is still alive. When Arahant passes away, then they're gone.
But then nothing there's still traces of transcendent in a lot of people.
Ah, yes. But I once just asked Ajahn Bhamalia, just getting the reference out now. So he said, where do you know in the suttas is the clearest example that after Parinibbana, full enlightenment, when an Arahat passes away, male or female, when a Buddha passes away, which particular sutta is the clearest example there's nothing left? And that is in the Salayatana Sutta. I'm just trying to get the reference for you here, where it says that, you know, that once the sense of sight, sound, hearing, hearing, tasted, felt, and known, the six senses, including the known, pass away, then no other sense of knowing occurs anywhere, in any place, in any form. So, as explained there, that all the senses gone, stopped, including knowing, the mind stopped without remainder. I'll just see if I can find the reference there, because I should be able to get it reasonably quickly, because it's well done again. Oh, okay. These six faculties were ceased completely and totally without remainder, and no other six faculties will arise anywhere in any way. It's in the Salayatana Sutta, number the 48th set of suttas, sutta number 53. So you can check it out for yourself. A very clear and powerful saying that there is no sense faculties remaining after Parinibbana.
I will just finish by just making a comment.
Yeah, go.
To me, it's very important, this jhana issue, because
yeah.
All my life, it's a very personal sharing. It doesn't matter, non-arahant, Sorry, I just go simple. What I mean is, there is a lot of people who are depressed, or there's a lot of people who got this nihilistic attitude.
Mm.
I think the courage is that if you accept the Buddha teaching is not a nihilistic kind of teaching,
good.
And embrace jhana,
yeah.
There is a saving grace, if you want to use the Christian word of saving grace instead of transcendental.
Okay.
You can definitely can accept the face that is nothing, and there's just a smear of nothingness. Just create beauty out of this smear of nothingness. Because by not by so many good teachers here are dividing over this issue of this self, I felt it's very, and with this internet, it's too much overload with data, and I can't even get a simple book for inspiration. And yeah. That's how I felt the last 20 years.
Yeah, very good. I understand and appreciate that. Very good. No, well done, Jay. Thank you. John?
back to the bhikkhuni issue.
Yeah.
I heard say that after the Buddha died and there was a meeting of all the arahants, the bhikkhuni sangha wasn't invited. Is that true or correct? Incorrect?
To the
first conference after the Buddha died. There's no account of the bhikkhuni sangha being there.
That's interesting, because they just said they invited a sangha of 500 arahants. Never actually mentioned the gender of them. So, I don't know. Would there have been bhikkhuni arahats who were alive at the time? Would they have been present? So, that I can't answer. There are certainly many bhikkhunis around, many bhikkhuni arahats. Would they have been invited? So, I don't know. But certainly the question of bhikkhunis in the time of the Buddha, many of them. And it's the only ones we know of were the ones who recorded their stories. And those stories were recorded, you know, in the sort of the Sutta Pitaka, and they were recited at that first council. So why not? So anyway, it's now 4:30, so I think it's the time to actually to end the session today. It's supposed to be a short session, but I knew it probably wouldn't be. But that's good. Everyone had the time. An hour and a half is actually the time which I allotted and expected for this. So, sadhu, sadhu.